Hey, I'm John.
And I'm Becky.
And this is the We Are For Good podcast.
Nonprofits are faced with more challenges to accomplish their missions and the growing pressure to do more, raise more, and be more for the causes that improve our world.
We're here to learn with you from some of the best in the industry, bringing the most innovative ideas, inspirational stories, all to create an impact uprising.
So welcome to the good community. We're nonprofit professionals, philanthropists, world changers, and rabid fans who are striving to bring a little more goodness into the world.
So let's get started. Oh, Becky, have we found a friend?
No, we are having my new best friend on the podcast today, and I'm so excited about it.
I mean, I am just so pumped for this conversation because not only did this individual get introduced to us by Evan Wildstein, who is just one of those people who just pours into this community, who cares so deeply about the sector and the people that are powering it, but he has introduced us to Jonah Nye, who is this incredible force as the Senior Vice President for Development and Alumni Engagement at the New School. And you know, friends, we like to have real talk around here. We don't have a lot of patience for things that are kind of skirting issues. And we brought Jonah on because he is going to talk to us about something that has not been centered in conversations. We're going to talk about cost, the cost of code switching for fundraisers of color, and the health effects of racism in the sector. So I want you to buckle up. But before we get into this heavy topic today, you got to know where Jonah came from because he's got like the most renaissance human I've ever met in my life, probably.
Totally.
Before he came to the New School, he was this accomplished fundraiser with more than 16 years of experience. He worked for the Jewish Museum. He was at the Major Gifts Officer for Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism. He was the Assistant Director of Development for Opera America. Hello. Are we counting
Obsessed.
Up all the arts roles and all the connections here? But Jonah's this incredible classically trained singer. We're asking for some music rights here. Maybe he'll sing by the end of today's episode. But he earned his undergraduate degree at the Lawrence University and a master's of music degree at New England Conservatory. You know what? Julie's sending us Instagram reels. He was also a baker and a semifinalist on season one of NBC's Baking It.
Like literally hanging out with Maya Rudolph.
I mean, what an honor to have somebody like you in this house, just ready to pull up a chair and let's have a conversation with a cup of coffee today. Jonah, welcome to the We Are For Good podcast. So glad you're here.
Thank you so much for having me. And as I was saying sort of in the pre-tape, I am so grateful for people like you in our field. We need more people with that caffeinated, aha, anything is possible attitude, because it is hard work and you have to, but we're called upon to be like that as leaders, right? To not yeah. be okay with the status quo.
Yeah. I mean, Jonah, okay, I gave you like bullets from your bio, but I feel like we could just sit and talk for hours. Give us a little bit of the through line of your story. What are some formative moments of growing up? We want to get to know little Jonah. What informed this work that you're pouring into and the way that you see the world today?
Sure. So I was adopted at pretty much right at birth. And I was born in California, then raised in the Midwest and in Virginia, too. So all over the place. I fell in love with opera around age 16 or 17 by a fluke. I was taking voice lessons. My teacher took me to one of her auditions just to sit and observe. And the panel decided they're like, let's hear the kid just to give them feedback, and they had a small role for me, and that's when I was hooked. So I think I came into that art form, which has a lot of stigma as being something elitist or something only for rich people. I just came into it as, it's just music theater in a foreign language, and I happened to like it. So I did that. I sang professionally, I went to school for it, as you mentioned, had a surgery on my voice when I was 26, had to stop that then, didn't know exactly what I wanted to do, so I just situated myself in a wide variety of communities. I trained to be a sommelier for a while and sat for the Court of Master Sommeliers exams in San Francisco. Oh, that was very fun. They were not my people. They like to stay up late. It turns out restaurant people have a lot of energy in ways that I don't have a lot of energy. Let's just say that.
Same, but love them. So,
yes, love them. Also, I mean, The Bear is kind of accurate. That show is
yes.
sort of accurate.
That show.
So then I moved to New York. I was a booking agent for dance, grant writing on the side, hated it. It felt like doing my taxes over and over again. So I was like, oh, I guess development's not for me. And then 07-08 hit and someone's like, sorry, you have to also do annual fund. I was like, great, what's that? And then realized, oh, it's just, I can just talk to people and ask for their money. That's a lot easier. So got myself situated in a shop like Columbia versus School of Arts and Journalism. And what I liken it to is, you know how like if you're a little kid and you have natural ability for an instrument or something like that? I think I had natural ability for fundraising. And then I learned my technique at Columbia. And then I took that technique to other places. And so that's how I think about my career. 18 years in the business now, and I've worked every station in the kitchen. So I think it's helpful to have started as a grant writer. It also helps that, you know, I work with operations a lot because there's a lot of people on the team that are, you know, you hear about the big gifts, but you don't necessarily hear about the people behind the curtain. So I just try to make a point of making sure that that work gets surfaced. And that, yeah, the baking thing was a fluke. I was a fine baker, whatever. It's a hobby. And my husband saw this thing. It looked like a Word document. Didn't say NBC or anything on it. It said, bakers and your helpers send in or apply for this competition, right? So my husband sent it to me on Instagram with no words. It's just with the GIF from Schitt's Creek of David and Moira fighting in the kitchen.
Wonderful. Singing, totally
fold,
relate.
Yeah. Fold in the cheese scene. And he and he was just like, oh, no, he did say, he's like, if we were ever on something like this, this is how we would be. Like, we'd be awful for it. So I was on a lunch break at my desk, and I filled it out and I forged his signature. And then I had to do a, they wanted a 30-second video. So I just did it from my desk. And I said, hey, I'm Jonah. I'm a diversity bingo card. Here's the boxes I fill for you. I said, I don't need America to like me. I have five friends, so I'm fine with the villain edit. I'll look dead-eyed into camera one and say, I didn't come here to make friends. I came here to bake, you know, and then and I just turned it in. I didn't think anything. And 3 hours later, a casting agent called from LA, from NBC. I did have to audition, though. For 4 months, I had to show videos of me making pie, of making a three-tiered cake, of me making this, of talking about what was in our kitchen. My husband was like horrified. He's the opposite. He's embarrassed if you look at him. So like he wanted none of this. The night before we were going to find out, NBC had said, we're going to let you know either way at a certain point. And he's like, I know you really want this, but if we don't get this, I'm going to be really relieved. And I was like, how could you say that?
Like, how dare you?
Yeah. And then we got cast and then, you know, it ended up being hysterical and fun. And it was like SNL meets Great British Bake Off. It was not competitive. No one cared if they won. It was about, you know, good vibes. Amy Poehler produces it. So, you know, her that sort of Parks and Rec, sunny disposition, really optimistic. It was just really silly and fun.
Oh my God. I mean, you, John said it best. You are a Renaissance man. You are a unicorn. And I love the natural curiosity. And you are at the new school. Do you, yes. I want the community to know about the new school. They started this sort of creator community, you know, in looking at education and intellectual, you know, curiosity in completely different ways and combining the arts. I want you kind of to just go over who is the new school, because you are such a powerhouse of development, your team, and what you all are doing is really revolutionary. Kind of set the stage for that mission for our audience.
Sure. So our interim president, Donna Shalala, who, you know, she was in the Carter administration, Clinton administration, Clinton Global Initiative, and a politician and a congressperson, she likes to joke that the new school has, we have none of the things that make you money. We have none of the things. We have none of the things that
and
a university
all the
needs
to bring like, you joy.
Yeah, yes. Sports, law, medicine, business school. We don't have any of that. So we were first of all, the branding is confusing because it's called the new school, but it's a university. So it's a university. It has campuses in New York and in Paris. A good way to think about it is over 70% of the 10,000 students are involved in some sort of creative practice. Making something, fashion, art, music, design. And then, of course, we have humanities and psychology as well. So the schools themselves, the branding themselves of the schools is probably more recognized than the name the new school. So Parsons School of Design, for example, in New York and in Paris, it's also the largest. Thank you, Project Runway, speaking of reality TV. The other colleges, College of Performing Arts, which has the landmarks Manis School of Music inside of it, School of Jazz and Contemporary Music, School of Drama. Then we have Eugene Lang School for Liberal Arts, the New School for Social Research, and the Schools of Public Engagement. So the origin story is that, you know, this is over 100 years old. A group of American intellectuals and educators were like, higher ed's moving too slow. It's too timid. We're going to start something new. So we've always been kind of branded as progressive, as anti-establishment. And then in the 1930s, they took German scholars who were fleeing Nazi Germany and made the Graduate School of Political and Social Science, so and called the University of Exile, which still exists today and sadly is still very relevant. So that's the school.
Tell us a little bit about your team, because I'm just so curious, this development team that gets to serve such a progressive cause too. I mean, you're at the helm of this. Talk a little bit about your team, because I just want some context. It's so fascinating.
Yeah, so the development and alumni engagement team, we are small for a university our size. It's about 30 folks, but we are growing, and I think it's one of the best out there, but I could be biased according to my bias awareness training that is mandatory. So, I mean, we cover all the major functionalities, annual major plan, principal giving, analysis, research, et cetera. One thing to note is that about 60% of our frontliners are BIPOC, and as you know, our field is just under 90% white. So we feel good about the work we've done. We've been very intentional. When I talk about this, you know, in other spaces, I'll say like 60% of the frontliners are BIPOC and they're qualified. How about that? So this idea of access and excellence being disarticulated, which is really pernicious in our field, that needs to stop. I say that on purpose.
Yes.
And then, you know, it's a lot more fun to show your values than talk about them. So that's that's what we try to do.
There's a Joan and I quote right there. Love that.
Yeah.
We don't always get it right. And I'm not saying, I think in general, who lives up to their ideals? No one lives up to their ideals. But what I will say is we definitely run hard at our values. We run towards our values. We don't run away from them. And, you know, we really do try to get it right. And it attracts, we attract a certain type of feisty worker. You know, like very anti-establishment. Let me just say
as
that.
A result.
Yeah. I was going to say, you. That's really about the movement I feel like you've built, which is when you, and we talk about this all the time, when you uplift your values and put them so front and center and you model them. And
you actually
you
do
reflect
them.
Reflect them and you point them out in your work. It's going to be a magnet to the people who also value those same things. And so one, I want to thank you for just the way that you are confidently, boldly talking about these systemic issues of racism in the sector. And we want to go hard into that today. So let's talk about this cost of code switching for fundraisers of color. Please first define what code switching means in the context of the nonprofit sector, and particularly for fundraisers of color.
Sure. First, I have to give a major shout out to Dr. Renee White. She's our provost and executive vice president, and she's a professor of sociology. She has really done this research well before this, you know, idea came to me. And then also my friend Melissa Manquist, who's a development director at NYU. She and I co-founded the Forum for BIPOC Fundraisers and have been talking about this. And then we thought, why don't we sort of take this on the road? So we've done it online. We've done it at CASE. We're doing it at Aspen Leadership Group in a couple of weeks and the University of Chicago later this summer. So it's like a weird touring band about racism. Fun.
Proud pleaser.
Thank you. So code switching, just it started as a sociolinguistic term about when people who are multilingual or bilingual would switch between languages. That was how it started. So language-based. Then in the 50s and 60s, it moved towards monolingual people and how would people switch between colloquial speech and or different kinds of dialects. And then since then, it's really expanded to talk about culture. So how do you present yourself? What are you wearing? What cultural references are you or are you not going to say? And language too. So it's broadened from language-based to all about culture and community.
Thank you for that context. Let's dive into like some specific situations, because specifically from like fundraisers of color, what does it look like in a professional environment to like feel like they need to code switch or feel like that they can't show up as their full self? Like walk us through what that looks like.
Yeah, so the why of it is it's really about safety and comfort and identity and community. So if you're in an environment where you can't relax your shoulders, where you feel like an outsider, you're going to have to engage in some other kinds of presentation of self. I want to give two pieces of research that Dr. White uses to reference. They're unusual, but they're profound in ways of thinking about these issues and how pervasive they are. So take the act of hand washing, for example. If you're at a restaurant or at the movies and you go and use the automated faucets, the infrared light that is in those faucets was beta tested on white men, and therefore it is meant to reflect off of light skin. Now, so people who have darker skin, the faucets generally don't work right away. You should see the looks on people's faces when she talks about this, Dr. Renee White, because BIPOC folks suddenly think, oh my God, I've had this happen. Someone's like, I thought they were broken. And I would say they were broken for you. And then another scary, stunning research, as we all talk about AI and its possibilities. Sure, fine. I'm an early adopter, you know, I had an iPhone 3 and all that stuff. But male presenting, male presenting ID is correct 99% of the time. For BIPOC folks, it is wrong 35% of the time.
Oh my
it's wrong
gosh.
35. And why is that? It was beta tested on white men. So these are just, they're kind of odd examples to translate onto the issue. But you can see if systems are invisible and they've been set up for whiteness, then there's no problem. If everything's working for you, then anyone for whom it's not working is either lazy or not trying or sensitive. What's the problem if it's invisible? So the reason that people have to code switch is for issues that a lot of times seem invisible to the majority, but just under 90% of our field is white. 83% of frontliners in higher ed are white. So the question of when do fundraisers of color code switch? All the time.
I was going to say every minute, probably.
Every minute at work, with donors, in life in general. I have specific clothes for different types of donors. People freak out when they see me in the real world and I'm wearing jeans. It's like, you know, when you see your second grade teacher for the first time at the grocery store, it's like, what? It's human? You know, so it's like, it's that kind of novel. I mean, people really do. They're like, they think it's really weird to see me not in a suit. So the answer is, sadly, it's all the time.
Thank you for hitting it between the eyes and for having some real talk about this. Because when you are aware of these things, it becomes a responsibility to make those cultures, make those environments less stressful. I am just thinking about the stress on the body, on the mind. I mean, emotionally, of having to hold that tension all the time. And I think, you know, we're all on our own like anti-racism journeys. I think each of us who've ever held privilege in any situation, because we don't know the things that have just been so easy for each of us. And so I wanted you to talk about the mental health aspect of this and the well-being, because we're already in this mental health crisis. We are knee deep into it. We are watching from our survey data, We Are For Good, what has happened to the sector as a whole in the mental health. And then you layer on something like racism, not having psychological safety in the offices that you're working in, that you're having to think about the way you talk, the way you move, the way you dress. I mean, this is just exhausting. I feel like it adds another layer of mental health stressor. So talk about how that's affecting, you know, communities that are marginalized and what we can do about it.
Sure. So, I mean, the short version is that, you know, racism is literally bad for your health. You know, research shows this. And again, Dr. White was sort of on the forefront of calling out racism as a public health crisis at a time when that just people hadn't kind of wrapped their brains around that. You know, managing how people see you versus how you really are is exhausting. And in social science terms, it's called protective surveillance. So it means when you're in spaces where you're always in some sort of anticipatory mode because you don't know what's going to happen. Am I safe? Am I less safe? Should I be more protective? That already it takes some wear and tear. And then add on, say, a microaggression or something worse happens. That moment goes away for the perpetrator, but the person who's been affected is still left with the residual effects. And that has cognitive effects, and that takes up brain space and capacity to do the work. So specifically, higher rates of hypertension, higher rates of stress, lower satisfaction in work and in life, because it's almost impossible to compartmentalize the work from these other spaces. Yeah, that kind of stuff bleeds into other things that you do. So it's got emotional, cognitive, physical effects. And for the employer, that means then turnover. So in a field that is already pretty quick on the draw for turnover, it's even faster than that.
I mean, help us connect the dots. You know, there's a lot of leaders that listen to this podcast too, of if you are trying to step into being more aware, more supportive, more helpful, I do feel like as a white human trying to like walk through this too, there's like a tension of, I don't want to create more harm or stress by asking questions or saying, please explain this to me, why this is problematic. But I also may be missing it. I may have used automatic faucets my whole life, and I would never have thought that. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, isn't that just a terrifying study? Yeah,
it's terrifying. But I'm like, that tension is real. Of like, I believe the people in this community really want to show up as our best selves, so everybody can show up as their best selves, their full selves. What does that look like in practical terms? How you can build into that culture? Thoughts on that?
Sure. So I thought Catherine and Fred Van Sickle did a great job at this conference last week. They talked about the difference between, well, their presentation was on intergenerational working relationships and, you know, their father, daughter, and they're both in the same business. So it was really interesting to see it play out. But they talked a lot about the difference between mentorship and sponsorship. You know, someone like me at this point in my career, 18 years, I don't really need another mentor. I need sponsors. And who are sponsors? They're people who have the kinds of power and positionality that I don't have in other spaces, in other rooms when I'm not there to advocate for the work and then not tell me about it. I don't need people to run and tell me about it. So that's one piece of it. A second piece of it is if you truly want to diversify your staff, and I get that institutional change is hard, fine. But if you actually mean it, you only have to do two things. And I know because I've done it. You need to have leaders of color because staff and prospective candidates need to see that it's actually a thing. And you need to not require them to live in communities where they are not safe. And that is the more controversial one, especially with the work from home, work in the office debate or whatever. But you cannot ask a person of color to move to an exclusively white community or rural community where they will not be safe. So you have to make choices. And this is, I steal from Dr. Melanie Hart, who used to be our head of equity, inclusion, social justice, the word salad of it all. This is how I think about it. Diversity is a fact. It's just a fact. We don't need to talk about that. Equity is a choice. Inclusion is an action and belonging is a result. So again, I don't even talk about belonging because belonging, you don't get to claim because that just, it happens or it doesn't. So I focus on equity and inclusion, the choices that are being made and the actions that are being made. And choices are budgets. Choices are prioritizing and making critical decisions around what is more important, having staff in the office, working and sitting at a cube to Zoom all day, or is it to actually open your search to other parts of the country where there's bigger populations of, you know, the minorities that you say you want to add to your team? And then inclusion is the actual action. So making the choices is really hard. But, you know, a lot of times consultants will come in to your point, John, like, how do I get at that information without inflicting, you know, awkwardness or harm? You know, consultants can give advice. That's what they're meant to do. And as I tell consultants, which I think is like the last stop for all of us, right? that's the exit ramp. I mean, no offense. I've been a consultant. I think it's fun. But I also think there's a very, I think it's a lot easier to make to give advice than it is to make decisions. And so those of us who are in positions where we have to make decisions, then you have to decide, how are you going to prioritize? And I have not seen institutions, big or small, actually prioritize the desire to diversify their staff. I see resolutions. I see a lot of what I call the whereas, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera documents. I see a lot of hyperlinks to books by Ibram Kendi. I see a lot of Heritage Month events, but I actually don't see critical decisions being made from the top down that would actually lead to an environment, a result of belonging.
I mean, I want to live and work in this world that you're talking about, and I feel like you're lifting the veil on some of the things that we don't even talk about, that we don't even see. And I want us to have the veil lifted. I think We're for Good as a community is a space where we don't want harm. We don't want suffering. We want abundance. We want inclusion. We want vibrancy and to thrive in this world. And we don't want to do it alone. We want to lock arms with the people next to us and bring them with us. And I think this focus on leadership is a really solid place to start, because one of our trends this year is focusing on the fact that our sector needs whole leaders. And we've been lifting this trend over and over. And it really comes down to not just the practice, but like, what are we doing in our humanity? What are we doing with our empathy? And what are we doing with those soft skills and building culture that make people feel safe, seen, and valued in this work? So talk to us a little bit about how we can build these cultures within our organizations and allow our leaders to show up as their whole selves, which will have a ripple effect down to the people who can also feel whole as a result of that.
Yeah, well, thank you for saying all that. And I know I just met you and John, but you do strike me as sort of yes and people. So there's this joke that like the difference between improv and stand-up, improv is yes and people, stand-up is no but. And I think Unfortunately, the majority of the people in our industry who have to make these decisions, I have found to be more than no, but column. So thank you for being a yes and person. But, you know, in terms of showing up as your whole self, this is cliche, but it is true. Leadership is everything from the board down. And, you know, even though higher education and I think increasingly other kinds of institutions have a shared governance model, there is no getting around the hierarchy and there's no denying it. So from, you know, work-life boundaries to consistency to open conversations about career goals to showing values, again, not just talking about them, if those in power and positionally have to demonstrate it. I will say a big caveat, though, I do not buy the bring your whole self to work talk. I don't buy it. I think we are paid to be there every day. You can't just say or do whatever you want without accountability. So to quote from Mad Men, that's what the money's for. that is why we are there. So that is the balance of being in a workspace. But I think bringing your whole self includes all those other, especially as leaders, it is actually understanding your team, actually getting to know them as humans. It just so happens I adore everyone on our team. So that is not a hardship. But if that's not the case for you, you still have to wrap your brain around doing that kind of work. That is what you are called upon to do if you are a manager.
I mean, I love your thoughts around that. And I know we just talked about whole leadership with Jennifer Mulholland and said, you know, sometimes we dress a certain way and it's not because we're trying to put on a front. It's called just discretion of like, you know, in this situation, maybe you need to show up this way. I wonder if that's kind of resonates with what you're saying too. It's not just like, I want to wear pajamas, so I'm going to wear pajamas, you know, and we're trying to close multi-million dollar gifts where there's a certain level of yes, like certainty that we want to come to this situation.
Yes, it is a profession. It is not. And that's, I think, also been interesting in the generational divide conversations. I usually say it this way to folks who may have old school notions of fundraising. It's like, it's a profession now. It's not a function. Perhaps in the 50s and 60s, yes, it was a function that was done behind doors. It was dirty. You didn't talk about it or something. But now, I mean, I'm hiring second generation fundraisers, you know, people like, you know, and I asked them like about their journey and they're just like, oh, my parents did it. Mm. And I love that it wasn't just this, I mean, I'm Gen X. So I think most of us are like, I stumbled into it stories, but I'm increasingly getting more stories of just like, well, it's a job. It's a job that my parents did.
Thank you for just for this conversation. I feel really fed and invigorated by it. And I don't know why, but I just feel compelled to tell you and any person who is listening to this podcast who has experienced any sort of harm because of who you are, I want to apologize. And I want to tell you don't deserve that. And I want to tell you that we can all be a part of making sure that doesn't happen for somebody else. And so thank you for bravely bringing this conversation in. I think you're a brilliant storyteller.
Thank you.
And we value stories so much on this podcast. And I wonder if there's a story of philanthropy that has stayed with you, maybe a story of generosity, of human kindness that you would share with our audience.
Sure. I mean, in general, I find planned giving to be the most moving to me personally and professionally. They are, of course, as you know, the donors that don't want to name a thing. They don't get the flashy headline. They're doing it because of other reasons. Americans, I think, in particular, are not good about talking about future plans or death and dying. So thankfully, I was trained very well by Michelle Cass when I was at Columbia about how to do this work. But I think of one gift in particular when I was working in a museum and I was working with a woman whose mother had recently passed and she wanted to do something in her honor, and very a significant gift. But at times, the conversation was just too raw. It was too recent for this individual. So I used a trick from the journalism school where I used to work at Columbia, and I did a walk and talk. And I just said, let's just talk about the objects in the museum and what they might bring up for you. So that was a way to get into the nostalgia and sort of culture. And then we were able to sort of do the work on our feet rather than trying to sit down and be like, okay, we have to talk about your mom's legacy. We have to talk about this. And so honestly, the largest gifts I've worked on have never been the ones that I'm the most proud of, for whatever reason. Yeah, the ones where I had to, where it meant a lot to the donor, and or I had to just show some level of tenacity on the border of like stalking. I think that that those ones I really, oh my God, there was this one. It took something like 17 or 18 moves. And I was calling this poor donor's assistant like monthly. And I'd be like, hey, you know, Becky, it's your monthly call from Jonah. And like at some point I was like, look, Becky, I'm either going to get a meeting or a restraining order, but you have to tell me right now, which one is it going to be? And she's like, you can have 30 minutes. And it's like, okay. And then we got in and we got the $150,000. But I was like, I probably could have let that one go, but I didn't. So.
You're too tenacious. You're not going to let those go.
It kind of made me mad because I'm like, just say no or don't pick up my calls, but you're picking up the phone. So I won't, you know. Yeah, anyway.
I feel like it was easier for you to get on the reality show than that. So that's impressive work.
Seriously, I'll bring up hi. This is funny though, because donors have asked since watching the show, you know, like, will you bring something? And it's like, that's very expensive now. I mean, oh, I will, yeah. But
Jonah
talk
walks
about
in
price.
With a 4-tier wedding cake. Like, oh, my God.
New School is a place where entertainment and arts and showbiz is actually, not frowned upon or seen as frivolous. Again, originator of Project Runway at Parsons, so they understand the power of branding and marketing and sometimes things just not having to be that deep all the time.
Yes. Yeah. I'm here for that.
Yeah. Okay, my friend, as we start to wind down this convo, we have to ask for a piece of advice from you. We ask for everybody's one good thing. It could be a habit that you've embraced, maybe just a piece of advice you want to leave with our community. What's your one good thing?
Sure. Sorry, I have five, but they're really fast.
You got the microphone.
Five
take
good
it.
Things, yes. Jonah. Go.
Okay. Five good things. Number one, as we talked about earlier, do you really want to diversify your staff? If you do, I feel like I'm on Las Culturistas and I'm doing a rant, but if you actually want to diversify staff, you have to have BIPOC leaders, and then you have to ask them, and you cannot ask people of color to live in communities that are not safe. The second one, another good thing, cynicism only supports the status quo. So as leaders, we are called upon to be unsettled by the status quo, so it's our duty to push it forward, even when it's hard. That's not for you, if it's too hard, then get out of the way. Don't be a leader. It's totally fine. Everybody has to make their own decisions. But there's no room for cynicism. It's like my kryptonite. Third, we need to unlearn the culture of helplessness that is pervasive in our field when it comes to these kinds of topics. So we have a learned helplessness both on the ally side and on the minority side. On the minority side, we have, you know, everyone's taught the donor is always right. We have learned that not all money is good money. Sackler, Epstein, we are beyond that day. We do not actually, if someone says something racist to you, you must hold them to account. On the ally side, well, what do? I'm just, you know, a white man or what, you know, a white straight man or something like this. It's like, no, you have choices. You have sponsorship, mentorship, elevating voices, saying the hard thing, helping if someone's getting talked over in a meeting, which happens all the time, being like, I want to go back to something that Jonah said. Would you say that again, Jonah? Because I'm not sure everyone was able to hear that. So this learned helplessness about these very difficult things has to go. The fourth one, exercise the agency that you already have. Stop asking for it, right? Mm. Everyone has power. The people, junior staff to me, who are white, they have certain power that I will never have. My gender gives me power that some women will never have. So it is about exercising the agency that you already have. Stop asking for it. Do the things that only you can do. That's what you need to focus on, especially as leaders, right? I had a really great boss, Dwight McBride, who would, when I was pulling my hair out about this or that, it's probably like an HR form or something, he'd be like, I need you to focus on only the things that Jonah can do. And I was like, fine, you know, that kind of thing. And then I said it early, the fifth good thing, it ain't that deep. So
It ain't that deep.
It starts to well up in you and you start just letting it weigh down, take a break, do some help, you know, bake a cake or whatever. Although that didn't cost me, like, that caused me so much anxiety. So, like, that's not that fun for me anymore. But whatever it is for you, it ain't that deep. Take a step back and then get back to the work.
That was like a mini masterclass in like how to be a whole human at this job. And I have to tell you, the one that's resonating the most with me is the rejection of cynicism.
Yeah.
And I think right now the world is is rife for you to jump in there and get angry. And hell, I'm angry about a lot of stuff. But if we can chase the purpose, the joy, the good, again, I'm going to pull this back to the new school values. Those become the magnets to the people that want to live in that kind of a world. So thank you for setting the tone for that, Jonah. I think you are just an extraordinary human. I wasn't kidding when I said I want you to be my new best friend.
Thank you.
Tell people how they can connect with you. Tell them like where you hang out online, how they can connect with the new school, and totally go check out Jonah's Instagram because the cake
we were dying.
The opera, all of it.
So I may regret this, but first of all, if anybody wants to have this, extend this conversation or help or do the work or has questions, they can just email me. I want to hear about your journey. And if I, you know, if I don't have the right set of maps for you, I'll you know, tell you to go to someone else who might. So it's nighj@newschool.edu. Again, my last name, nighj@newschool.edu. For the fun stuff, TikTok, I'm apparently, I'm better at that. For the work stuff, LinkedIn. And that's where you'll also find the forum for BIPOC fundraisers, a free resource for fundraisers of color that is completely free. You just have to sign up on LinkedIn. Instagram, NyJonah. Facebook, Jonah Nye. So that's it. Those are all my things. And I really don't do Twitter because it's stupid.
I just have to say from my arts mother, the soprano, just thank you for seeing the world in color. Thank you for bringing others with you. I can't wait to just follow your journey and learn more from you. Thanks for coming in today.
Yeah, thanks for making this space, Becky and John.
Thanks so much for being here, friends. And you probably hear it in our voices, but we love connecting you with the most innovative people to help you achieve more for your mission than ever before.
We'd love for you to come join our good community. It's free, and you can think of it as the after party to each podcast episode. Sign up today at weareforgood.com/hello.
And one more thing. If you love what you heard today, would you mind leaving us a podcast rating and review? It means the world to us, and your support helps more people find this community. Thanks so much, friends. Can't wait to our next conversation. Rabbit fans have always powered the We Are For Good podcast, but now Rabbit fans can get even more goodness and access by joining Good Friends. It's our listener support community for the We Are For Good podcast.
Good Friends comes with perks, exclusive episodes with John and I, including The Good Brief, our new monthly cliff notes of the greatest takeaways and lessons learned from that month, and exclusive AMA episodes where we answer your burning questions and tap our community of experts. Join now or learn more at weareforgood.com/friends.
We can't wait to see you inside. That's weareforgood.com/friends.